Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania, it's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, we are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better. It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnton.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnton, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Friday on this 27th day of May, 2016, on Memorial Day weekend eve. And I hope that God richly blesses you all this weekend as you prepare for a nice long time, at least most of you, a nice long three-day weekend of gathering with family, friends, and loved ones. And I hope that God blesses you with safety and refreshment and invigoration and fellowship and leading those that you know and love to Jesus Christ when you have the opportunity. And of course, don't forget the veterans that you know, the veterans in your community, and those in your own family, and the families of those veterans who are deceased, who have laid down their lives for the freedoms that we enjoy in the United States of America. So I just wanted to wish you all a happy Memorial Day before I run out of time. But I think that it's a very apropos that we have today as a guest on Memorial Day weekend eve, Larry Pratt, who is the Executive Director Emeritus of Gun Owners of America. And Larry Pratt is the Executive Director, as I said, of this organization, which is a national grassroots organization representing more than 1.5 million Americans dedicated to promoting their Second Amendment freedom to keep and bear arms. Gun Owners of America lobbies for the pro-gun position in Washington, D.C., and is in Washington, D.C., and is involved in firearm issues in the United States. GOA's work includes providing legal assistance to those involved in lawsuits with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the Federal Firearms Law Enforcement Agency. And Pratt has appeared on numerous national radio and TV programs, such as CNN's Piers Morgan, NBC's Today Show, CBS's Good Morning America, CNN's Crossfire, and Larry King Live, Fox's Hannity and Combs, and many others. He has debated Congressman James Traficant Jr. of Ohio, Charles Rangel of New York, and Carolyn McCarthy of New York, Senator Frank Loudenberg of New Jersey, and Vice President Al Gore, among others. His columns have appeared in newspapers across the country, and he published a book, Armed People Victorious, in 1990, and was editor of a book, Safeguarding Liberty, the Constitution and Militias, in 1995. His latest book, On the Firing Line, Essays in Defense of Liberty, was published in 2001, and Pratt has held elective office in the state legislature of Virginia. Serving in the House of Delegates, Pratt directs a number of other public interest organizations and serves as the vice chairman of the American Institute for Cancer Research. It's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Larry Pratt. Welcome, brother. Can you hear me? That's interesting. Larry, what happened to Larry Pratt? For some reason, our guest is not on the line, and I have no idea why. So we're going to go to a station break earlier than we thought. No idea why Larry Pratt is not on the line with us. And God willing, he will be returning any second now. So if you could, please stay tuned with us while we go to a commercial break and find out what happened to Larry Pratt, because he was on the phone just a few minutes ago. So I'm not sure what happened here. Anyway, if you'd like to join us, by the way, with a question for Larry Pratt, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnzen, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis. And World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your world trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wmg.org/ironsharpens today.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Welcome back, and I believe we now have Larry Pratt back on the line with us. Larry?
Okay, sir. We're working now.
I'm not sure what happened, but I'm glad that God seems to want you on the program today since we have a reconnection here, and it is my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time ever to Iron Sharpens Iron, Larry.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
And let me repeat our email address if anybody would like to join us on the air about gun ownership with a question. Email us at chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please provide your city and state and residence and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. Well, I already gave a description before you came back on the air with us of GOA, Gun Owners of America. How, Larry, did you personally get involved in GOA, and what began this enthusiasm with you over guns and the Second Amendment?
Well, it was not so much an enthusiasm over guns as the opportunity when it presented itself to defend the Constitution. I was an activist working in Washington, D.C. I'd been with the American Conservative Union, among other outfits in Washington, and a California state senator had formed Gun Owners of America and was looking for somebody to head up the office because he knew that if he were going to lobby the Congress, that had to be done from Washington. And so we got hooked up, and I've been with Gun Owners of America ever since really the mid-70s, and it's been quite a ride because we've, over the years, been able to increasingly have an impact on the legislative process here in Washington, and not always to the thrill and excitement of even sometimes people on our own side, because we have taken a position that the Constitution can only be amended by the rather laborious procedures laid out in the Constitution, and it's not something for us to be at liberty to willy-nilly fiddle here and there with the Constitution. So we've taken a pretty hard-edged position defending the Second Amendment, and of course that doesn't always make us popular throughout the city.
Yeah, and in fact, I want to give a plug to our listeners. If you also want to listen to other programs that I've done on the subject of gun ownership, after this program is over, of course, you could go to our archive at ironsharpensironradio.com and look up our interview with John R. Lott, who is the author of More Guns, Less Crime. And you can also look up our interview with Dr. Ron Gleason, who has a book that is soon to be released by Solid Ground Christian Books, solid-ground-books.com, on the Christian and the Second Amendment. So you can find those interviews at ironsharpensironradio.com. But what I was saying during the initial introduction at the beginning of the program, Larry, is that I think it's a very fitting subject, Guns Owner of America, to be discussing this on the eve of Memorial Day weekend, because don't you believe that this issue is at the heart of what America has always had as a bulwark against tyranny, a country that is filled with armless sitting ducks is basically open game for a tyrannical power to move in and become a dictatorship over helpless people. Am I right?
Most definitely. There's two aspects to being defenseless, disarmed, that people ought to consider. One is that in all of the mass murders that have occurred in our country since 1950, all but two have occurred in what we have legally designated gun-free zones. Hmm. Obviously, that doesn't work out real well. They're not so gun-free when a dirtbag comes in with his own gun. Not really worried about whatever the penalty might be for violating the gun-free zone law, because he has something much more in mind than a piddly little citizen disarmament law. But to your point particularly, the most recent country that has been in the news that has had a sordid history of gun control is that of Venezuela, where it has become impossible to buy ammunition and new firearms. This has been over the last 4 years or so, and the last days of the not very lamented dictator Chavez, Hugo Chavez, and then his successor, Mr. Maduro. Both of these guys are socialist, Marxist tyrants who are extremely hostile to individual gun ownership. And wouldn't you know, these are the two places in our hemisphere, the one place that under these two dictators that has been most afflicted by socialism, by starvation, by government thuggery, by people fleeing the country when they have the means to do so. And so now we've got Cuba followed by Venezuela, and I'm afraid that our president doesn't seem to have any problem with this kind of government growing like a cancer not that far south from our own border.
Hmm. We do have a listener in Mastic Beach, Long Island, New York, Tyler, who asks, why do you think that President Obama is trying to blame weapons rather than the people who own them to go out on these massive and psychotic shooting sprees? I guess you could expand that to more than just President Obama, but every leftist in the, not only in the United States, but in the world, who does not believe in private gun ownership, or at least wants to make it very difficult.
And frankly, there are plenty of Republicans to go around who have supported that, if only tacitly, by, in the case of congressional Republicans, they had the opportunity to defund various Obama programs that would have attacked his gun control assault on the American populace, and they have simply declined to do so. They're men without a backbone. They're afraid of a political fight, and they simply won't do it. And so Obama has been able to roll right along, imposing his socialist agenda. And part of that is a very concerning database that's been built up of so-called medical diagnoses, which are being used starting with the Veterans Administration, turning them over to the Justice Department under President Bush, and now becoming a much more government-wide problem under President Obama, where these diagnoses become the predicate of saying, if you have one, you can't have a gun. And we've actually had members tell us about knocks on the door as a result of these Bush and Obama policies of conflating medicine and gun control. We ought to be extremely concerned about this, because this is what Hitler did. This is what Lenin did. They corrupt, they prostitute medicine and use it as a tool of the regime. And one of the targets of this tool is gun ownership.
Yeah, you know what's ironic, and I'm assuming this must be purely out of ignorance, but you have a lot of liberal people who obviously are those who are foremost opposed to gun ownership rights, and or at least they want to make them extremely more difficult. And yet they could very well be sitting ducks under a regime that despises what they believe. For instance, if you go into countries where there is Sharia law under Islamic rule, those liberals would be the first to have their heads on the chopping block for their views on sexual immorality and so on. There are many reasons why liberals should not even want their guns taken away. Even you have a lot of liberals who are claiming that the police in the United States are involved in a police state kind of a situation, and where they feel helpless and harmless. It doesn't even make sense that liberals in that group within the African-American community and so on would want to have weapons taken away, especially even when you have people in those high crime areas. Now, I'm assuming that most of those guns being used in crimes and murders and so on, in the urban areas especially, I'm assuming those are not legally owned guns. But even if they were, wouldn't it make more sense for those people to be armed to protect their homes and their family and themselves?
Well, the liberal seems to place priority in his thinking on control by the government. There's something in their thinking that accepts the legitimacy of virtually anything a government might do. And so they'll say, well, it's something that we need to have. It's proper to have government approval, a background check, of somebody buying a gun. But they would recoil in horror if you suggested the same thing for the First Amendment, saying that, well, let's have a background check then before an editorial can be published in a newspaper or broadcast over electronic media, including the Internet. Man, would that ever get a backlash? So they get it in some places, and I think it is because in those places they already have control.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not about ready to relinquish that or have any exceptions, whereas in the area of guns, they don't have control. They don't really like guns except in the hands of the police. And so that's an area that they've been particularly aggressive in trying to use the government, use the state, to disarm people, because they're assuming that people can't own a gun for any good reason. I don't think they look at it in these very terms, but their thinking ends up saying, without them really having thought it through, perhaps, I don't mind all the dead bodies from the criminals. I just don't want those patriot types running around with guns, posing a potential threat to the government.
Yeah, it's really absurd when you think about it. Now, obviously, there are those even who claim to be Christian who have a liberal bent on this issue. They view Jesus Christ and his meek and mild and humble attributes only. They forget about him turning over tables in the temple and
with a cat of nine tails,
right?
Particularly nasty instrument,
right? But they you know, go to passages which command that we turn the other cheek and distort them and so on. Why do you think that gun ownership is completely compatible with being a Bible-believing Christian and an obedient Bible-believing Christian?
On the Gun Owners News website at gunowners.org, we've got a fact sheet that we put out a number of years ago that deals with the Bible and guns. And it's a fairly systematic, it's not completely exhaustive, but it's pretty systematic treatment of what the Scripture says, Old and New Testament, about the legitimacy, in fact, I would argue the requirement of when it's necessary, when it's appropriate, using lethal force to defend innocent life. That's why we have police. But it goes beyond that because the police power, both biblically and in our constitutional republic, is predicated on having been vested first in the people, preferably understood as the people under God, and then from them emanating to the police as employees of the people under God, under Constitution, under law. And that is probably not something that some of these liberal theologians want to hear, because they've looked at the Bible from, I guess I would argue, their own set of views, trying to impose those views on Scripture rather than trying to let Scripture speak for itself, which it's quite capable of doing. And that's what we tried to do in the piece at gunowners.org, is to show that throughout the Scripture, Old and New Testament, you find a consistent teaching that, well, to quote one of the Proverbs, for the righteous to give way to the wicked is the same as a murky spring or a polluted well. In other words, giving way doesn't mean letting somebody through on a crowded road. It means giving way to a bad guy who, say, wants to take your wife. To give way to him is disgusting in God's eyes. And that's why, that's a good reason why we should be armed and able to protect ourselves and those that we're responsible for. And every man who's the head of a household has more than his own skin that he's responsible for.
So obviously you do not believe that Jesus Christ taught pacifism.
No, he didn't teach it when he was whipping the money changers out of the temple. And nothing in the New Testament, I think, could be shown to that effect. When Christ argued turn the other cheek, he in part was addressing a cultural way of thinking which tried to use provocation of a relatively minor sort, such as a slap on the cheek, which would be intended, go back to our own South, where it was last kind of part of the culture in our country, although I don't think it was limited to the South. But if you wanted to start a duel in the South, typically you'd get a glove and go whap another guy on the face with it. It wasn't life-threatening, but it was considered uber insulting, and the only thing that a real man could do was to accept the challenge to the duel. And one of the things that Christians taught was that that's being slapped on the cheek. That's exactly what Christ was talking about, that you don't respond in kind. If your life is not being threatened, keep your gun in its holster.
Yeah, it's interesting that even Jesus Christ, when he was confronted by soldiers asking him questions, he said he just told them to not take money from anyone by force.
Right. Don't be a thief. Don't use your office to abuse others.
Right, and
Peter responded by cutting off Malchus's ear when the guards were coming in from the temple to grab him illegally in the middle of the night, he didn't say, "Peter, what in the world are you doing with that sword?"
Right.
Like he didn't know, right? Like he'd only had dinner with him shortly before that, and all during the time that they were praying, or he was praying, Peter had that sword, and another disciple had one as well. No, he said that, "Don't you think my father could have sent a legion of angels to save me?" In other words, this is not the time to use it, Peter. And that was the point. Peter had none of the disciples. Nobody understood that God had actually come to earth to die to pay for the sins of other men, and that just, does not compute. And so Peter arose and got his sword and was going to defend the most magnificent person he'd ever met in his life. And he was rebuked for doing it at that time in that place.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that John the Baptist also told the soldiers to be content with their wages, so that would infer that he wanted them to continue being soldiers.
Absolutely. He didn't rebuke them, but as you were indicating earlier, just said, you know, don't take advantage of your office. Don't take advantage of people because you have a sword and they may not have one.
Mm-hmm. And of course, those who are liberals and leftists, who are not pure pacifists, like say the Amish and others, they
have guns to shoot animals with.
Right, right. But those that are your typical left-leaning Democrat or left-leaning Republican who is in favor of very strong, strict restrictions on gun ownership, they would even agree that the military needs guns and weapons and so on. But
so isn't that interesting? It's okay for somebody else to kill, but not them.
Now,
is, is it really a universal requirement that God would have of us that we not kill? I don't think so, because if they want to go back to, say, Exodus, where it doesn't really say don't kill, it says don't murder. But right after that commandment is given, it then proceeds to give a number of circumstances we might encounter where killing is mandated. Killing of the aggressor, killing of the murderer, of the kidnapper, and so forth.
Yes, and it's interesting how these same left-leaning individuals claim very often to be the champions for the defenseless, the poor, the women of society, the children of society, and yet they would rather than be sitting ducks without weaponry of any kind, you know, especially the women in the inner cities and so on. How could you really be in favor of women, women's rights and in their best interest if you want them to be unarmed in dangerous places? Doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. And my guess is that most of those taking this pacifistic position don't live in the very place that you're talking about, because if they had the money, they'd do what a lot of inner city women do, and that is pack a piece in their purse.
Right. And that goes to another area of hypocrisy. We're going to go to a brief break, but before we go to the break, I want you to think about something that I have said to people who who will rebuke me when I say anything in favor of gun ownership and so on, gun rights, the NRA, whatever you may think of when you are thinking of gun ownership. Liberals who are typically at least in their rhetoric, the ones who are far superior in their calling for the rights of minorities and the impoverished and so on, I will say to them, tongue in cheek, you know something, you're right. I think that only the rich, white, and powerful should own guns. And then, of course, they would say, what on earth are you talking about? What are you, some kind of a racist? And I would retort to that, no, I'm not the racist. You are, because you're the one that actually believes that. You may unconsciously believe that, but if you're saying that the government should be in control over all guns in a nation, you're really saying the rich, white, and powerful are the only ones who should have gun ownership and should have control over all of them. But I'll have you comment on that when we return from a break.
Sure.
Our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com if you'd like to join us. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
Finances and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnson, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis. And World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes biweekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your world trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wmg.org/ironsharpens today.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnson, and if you just tuned us in, our first guest today on the program is Larry Pratt, who is the Executive Director Emeritus of Gun Owners of America. And if you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. But Larry, if you could respond to my sarcastic, tongue-in-cheek retort that I give to liberals who try to shout me down against gun ownership. And my retort, as I said earlier, was a sarcastic reply. Yeah, sure, I think you're right. We should only allow the rich, white, and powerful to own guns. So if you could respond to that.
Well, Well, maybe they would be happy by just shifting situation only a little bit. Nazi Germany, the Nazis were the only ones allowed to own guns.
Mm-hmm.
Soviet Russia, only the communist elite and police were allowed to own guns. Idi Amin's Uganda, only the police and military were able to own guns. Pol Pot's Cambodia, only the, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is that really what they want? Do they have some guarantee that their utopia of a gunless society won't end up being some kind of historical dystopia where the misery of the people is enormous?
Yeah, in fact, a lot of what the liberals on TV, the pundits and the talk show hosts and others who chuckle at the conservatives who believe very passionately in gun ownership and support the NRA and other things like that, they chuckle at us because they think that we are like paranoid, frightened people who have this science fiction view of our government here in the United States morphing into something like the Nazi Germany of the early 20th century. And they think that that's ridiculous. That's never going to happen in a place like the United States of America. Are you kidding me? And they just think it's laughable that we would think that, oh, we got to have our militias ready to overthrow the government in case it becomes a tyranny and a dictatorship again or whatever.
They've never talked to people that have fled communist and Nazi and other tyrannies. When you ask them, would it have been do you think it would have made a difference had you and others had firearms and particularly had some tradition of the people actually organizing as a separate source of power apart from the government? And they kind of look at you like, well, of course. What world are you living in? And so to call this the victims of tyranny paranoid shows at best kind of a rather dangerous ignorance.
Yes, and they also, these liberals and leftists seem to be totally blind as to what could occur when we don't even know how many centuries this planet has left in store for it. We don't know with certainty when Christ is returning. And who knows what could happen over a span of time, like 20, 30, 40, 50 years, 100 years. What could happen to a country like ours? America may be completely evaporated from the face of the earth in such a period of time.
There were an awful lot of people in Germany in the 30s that just couldn't imagine those stupid street thugs, the Nazis, mm-hmm. ending up becoming a totalitarian monopoly of power in the mid-30s and on in through the World War. Same with people living in the Soviet Union and other countries. The Cubans that I've talked to that have fled Cuba after the rise of Castro just couldn't imagine that something like this would happen. In fact, it's interesting that Senator Cruz's father fought Castro with fought Batista with Castro, fought the dictator preceding Castro, and then when they toppled him, and it turned out that Castro had been lying through his teeth, he really was a communist, it wasn't just a figment of the State Department's imagination, and that he was turning out to be even worse than Batista had been, and he went back and saw with his own eyes. He fled Cuba again a second time, if you will. People just couldn't get it through their head, and many didn't ever make it out of these countries. Cruz's father was one of the ones who was able to, but that wasn't that didn't come easy. He had, and as we know, many Cubans have fled through the shark-infested straits between Cuba and Florida, and still do, and it's a regular occurrence when our Coast Guard finds empty little dinghies bobbing in the water, and sometimes they find a body that's been eaten by sharks.
Yeah, and we do have a listener. It's actually a frequent co-host on Iron Sharpens Iron. Reverend Buzz Taylor is listening today. He's on vacation day as his daughters are visiting Carlisle, Pennsylvania from Maine and other places, spending a nice day with them. And yet he still finds time to tune into Iron Sharpens Iron. And he has a question for you. Reverend Buzz asks you, if I should ever have to actually use my handgun for defense purposes, is it true that I would lose my right for exercising it?
One has to be very sure of what the laws of the jurisdiction are where that, God forbid, that sort of thing might happen. If you're in New York City, the first question might be, how did you get the gun? Because only about 1,000 people, last I heard, out of some 8 million, actually legally have a permit to carry a firearm. And most crimes against persons occur outside the home. So the question really deals with what happens to me under the law if I'm outside my home and I have to use my firearm. If you're in San Francisco, if you're in Chicago, if you're in New York City, and many other cities, or even sometimes other jurisdictions, try Hawaii, you could be in real trouble. So you probably need to think this thing through before you decide you're going to be carrying a firearm. And it's enough that I know I was kind of aware of the laws of Maryland and Virginia and the district. I'd gone to school in the District of Columbia. I had left the area to take a job in the Midwest, and I had an opportunity to come back and head up the American Conservative Union. And I knew almost without thinking, after having lived in the area, there's no way I'm going to live in the district, even though that would have been convenient to my job. It's easier to get into the district from Maryland. That would have been the second best commuting opportunity. But I knew ahead of time, no way. And I did my house hunting in Virginia. And it wasn't so much because of the taxes, although that was certainly one of the factors, but mainly it's that at least in Virginia, there's not a presumption against your defending yourself.
And we do have a listener, Harrison, in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, who wants to know, do you have any idea why it is that even many very conservative Christians in Europe, when it comes to their theology and doctrine, who are in alignment with the conservatism in the United States when it comes to biblical inerrancy and morality and the family, etc., why it is that many of these European brethren are very much in favor of gun control and actually applaud our President Obama for his views of strict rules against private gun ownership?
To keep in mind, I've actually had to face that very issue. I've been to Europe a couple of times, been to England, been to continental Europe, been to other parts of the world, and it's really stunning that the use of the word conservative, there's a conservative party, actually, the Tories, in England, but the only thing in common between their conservative party and an American conservative is the word conservative. The actual meaning is so very different politically in the two places, and it's largely the same in the rest of Europe. It's not uniform, but it's pretty much the same. There's simply no tradition of resisting the government, of the people being in charge of the government. We even have a different nomenclature. In America, those of us who are here by birth are citizens. In Europe, the best you're going to achieve is being a subject.
Hmm.
And believe me, that makes a world of difference.
Hmm.
We are the boss of our government. And even in England, where we brought some of these concepts at the time of the initial colonial settlement, it wasn't traditional English thinking. In fact, the reason they were leaving England is because their Christian beliefs simply no longer comported with being a good Englishman, and they had to get out of Dodge. And that, I think, helps explain why the word conservative just doesn't mean the same thing over there as it does here. They look at us as crazy people, you know, our militia tradition and our notion that King George was a tyrant, and anybody that had gotten a good shot off at him would have been doing a good thing. You know, you say something like that over there, and you just get a kind of stunned silence.
Well, you know, that actually brings me to another question. There are people, in fact, I would say the majority of conservative Christians in the United States do believe that the Bible is very clear that we are to be submissive to the governing authorities over us, because we believe God has ordained those authorities, even if we dislike them. And so how do you respond to the fact that a Christian, even if we're overrun by a tyrannical government, the argument would be we should just be willing to submit to them, even if we hate it and despise it, because we are just being obedient to the Bible?
Well, if we're being obedient in the situation you describe, we're not being obedient to the Bible. We're being obedient to usurpers who are defying God. Romans 13 describes a proper government as being a minister of God, a servant of God. And you can't, I don't think, make a very good case that Hitler was a servant of God, or that Stalin was a servant of God, or et cetera, all these tyrants of the last century up until the present day. So I think it's a major, serious confusion to think that Romans 13 is talking about being submissive to any Tom Fool tyrant that comes along and says, I'm the government, now you obey. The proper Christian response is, do you understand the Hebrew Republic? Do you understand what Paul was talking about? If you don't, then go to the back of the class and we'll talk later, see if you understand after due study.
Well, what about, like, for instance, I know that this is just a very tiny minority these days of Christians, but there is a tiny handful of Christians. Maybe it's bigger than I know it to be, but it's at least a very silent or rarely heard group of people who actually believe that the patriots of the 18th century, the colonists and so on, were in sin when they started a revolution against the British throne for independence of the colonies. They say that even if they enjoy the freedoms that procured for them today, they believe that that was actually sin on the parts of those colonists. And obviously back then, there were loyalists who were Christians who agreed with that notion. How do you respond to that kind of a thing?
Well, I think they're just missing the point of what we've been discussing, and they're assuming that because the king headed the current government of the day, that made him automatically legitimate. That would mean Stalin was legitimate, or that Hitler was legitimate. And frankly, I think the only thing wrong with the officers' plot to blow up Hitler that failed because they put the bomb on the wrong side of a mm-hmm. heavy oak table, mm-hmm. Was that they screwed up. You know, it's too bad the bomb didn't do what it was intended to do. Millions of people might well have been spared had they succeeded. The idea that anybody in power who says, I'm the government now, you got to obey me, really? And he's sitting there giving the finger to God, and we're saying that's legitimate? I really find that appalling.
And when it boils down to it, aren't those, at least those who are genuine Christians, who truly cherish the Second Amendment and the freedoms to and the rights to bear arms that we have here in the United States, isn't it true that the real root of that is not because they are bloodthirsty and want to shoot, harm, or kill people? It's the opposite. They want to protect innocent life, which should be a goal of all humanity. And according to what the liberals' rhetoric is, that is a part of their, it seems, main part of the main part of the agenda that they profess is to be protectors of the underdog and the helpless and innocent. Isn't that really just at the root of why people want to own guns who are coming from a biblical standpoint?
That I think that biblical standpoint very much comports with what the founders had in mind when they gave us the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment was based on a recognition that life is a gift from God, not from the government. And when the government acts without authority, which is laid out in Scripture, certain limited circumstances where government can take life. They can take the life of a murderer. They can take the life of a kidnapper. They can take the life of a rapist. But once you've gone past those enumerated areas where the taking of life is legitimate, self-defense obviously being another, then you've got a much harder argument to make. And to say that any government is legitimate because it's the government completely misunderstands, fails to think through what it is the Scripture actually teaches and what the founders of this country were very concerned. When you read what the colonial pastors were preaching about the king, it's clear that the king was the guy that was the lawbreaker. And it was often the preachers themselves. In fact, I am now looking at a reproduction of a painting on my wall of Pastor Peter Muhlenberg, a Lutheran pastor in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, who at the beginning of hostilities of our war for independence strode into his pulpit, gave a fiery Lamentations 3, I think it was, sermon about it. There's a time for this and a time for that, and he flung off his coat at the end of the cloak at the end of the sermon and said, and now there's a time no longer for peace, this is a time for war. And he was dressed in a colonel's uniform in the American colonial army under soon to be General Washington. He strode down the aisle of his church outside and mustered his men, and many of them signed up on the spot. They rode off to fight with General Washington, not to return until the war was over. That's what our Second Amendment is designed to protect, the ability to protect us against George III. And if George III insists on it, for us to be able to shoot him.
We do have another listener in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, Christian, has a three-part question, and they're all excellent, so I'll permit three parts. Is there anyone that you believe should not be permitted to own guns? What do you believe should be required of an American citizen before he can own a gun? And do you believe there are any weapons at all that should be restricted from private ownership?
Well, let me start with the third part of that. I think it's pretty clear from not only the Second Amendment, but the Militia Act of 1791, which was virtually contemporaneous with the final ratification of the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment, is that what the founders had in mind was whatever else they were protecting, the right of the people to protect themselves with the military arms of the day that would be carried by the average soldier. Now, they provided for cannons and whatnot in the Militia Act, but they made it clear that if you were in a militia and you were in a company that was involved with artillery, with cannon, all well and good, but you still had to have the military rifle with you. So they were looking at the military arm that every soldier would have. Today, that would be a machine gun. Not a heavy machine gun, but the M16 battle rifle. That's what they were thinking about, so that there would be an, if you will, an instant army. There would be a militia that was able to take on George III if need be. Give me the first two parts of that question, Ian.
Is there anybody that should be restricted from gun ownership, in your opinion? And what would be the requirements of somebody, an American citizen, in your opinion, before they are able legally to own a gun?
Well, I don't think there should be any requirements. Once the government gets involved in that, then the creature of the Constitution all of a sudden becomes the creator of the Constitution. And it takes primacy then over its creator. So I think it's completely wrong for the government to be telling people, you can't have a gun. If somebody's in jail, he shouldn't have a gun. When he gets out of jail, there's no way you're practically going to keep him from getting a gun. We've seen that in gun ban cities like Washington, D.C., in the past, Chicago. Criminals just are not deterred by bans and other gun control laws. So not only, I think, are they unconstitutional, but they really don't work. And we're kidding ourselves to think that the government should or can successfully be involved in gun control. So I don't think the government should be saying that I can't have an M16 or a 38, and the government shouldn't be involved in keeping track of whether I sell my next-door neighbor a 38 revolver or not. It's just not their business. If I do something wrong with that gun, then it becomes their business. That's what the government is for. And it should be a terror to me and everybody else to keep us from sticking up a 7-Eleven with my 38 revolver.
Well, it's interesting that many conservatives would be very much in favor of stricter punishment for those who commit crimes, and it may even include punishment that follows them outside of their prison cells when they are paroled or set free, etc. I'll give you an example, like a child molester. That person, very conservative people and very conservative Christians are often very much in favor of that person having a scarlet letter, if you will, something that identifies them to the communities where they live as a danger to children. Would you not think that a dangerous criminal might have something that follows him outside of prison with his restriction in regard to gun ownership?
If we don't think somebody can be trusted outside of prison, then we have to ask, why are they outside of prison?
That's a good point. Well, I'd like you to sum up in about a minute what you most want etched in the hearts and minds of our listeners today before we leave.
The role of government should be to be, as Romans tells us, to be a minister of God. It should be a comfort to the godly and a terror to the ungodly. That's not necessarily the exact wording of all the translations, but I think that's a pretty faithful rendition. If government is not doing that, government is wrong. Government is not to be respected. Government is not to be obeyed. Gun control laws are only a terror to the godly, not to the ungodly. Gun control laws should not be obeyed.
Well, it's been an honor and a privilege having you on the program today, Larry. I look forward to having you back, and I want to let listeners know that your website is gunowners.org. That's gunowners.org. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, Larry.
It was great to be with you. Look forward to it again.
Great. Well, God bless you, brother.
You too. Thank you.
And I also want to thank Eric Wallace, who actually informed me about Larry Pratt. Eric Wallace, who is a good friend of Larry, who I met at the Harvey Cedars Bible Conference not long ago when the Reverend Buzz Taylor and I went at the invitation of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals and the owners of the Harvey Cedars Bible Conference, and also P&R Publishing, who gave us free room and board and entrance into the conference there, the pastor's retreat that they had, where I met Eric Wallace. And thank you, Eric, for introducing me to Larry. But we're going to be coming right back after this break with our second guest for the day, John D. Wilsey, who is the author of American Exceptionalism and Civil Religion, Reassessing the History of an Idea. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions, like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new Topical Reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Tired of box store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times, 631-929-3512, or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnson, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your world trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wmg.org/ironsharpens today.
And look for the new Iron Sharpens Iron Radio full-page ad in World Magazine coming out on their June 25th edition dedicated to the best in Christian books. So we hope that you look for us in World Magazine with a total of four full-page, full-color ads that World Magazine is gracious enough to be giving us in an advertising trade on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, and we were thrilled that they were so thrilled with our recent Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastors Luncheon that they wanted to extend that trade with us. So thanks to Jonathan Bailey and Jonathan Woods and everybody over at World Magazine for this wonderful partnership that we have begun on. But now I'm very excited to introduce our second guest, who is on our program for the very first time ever, Dr. John D. Wilsey. He has written a book called American Exceptionalism and Civil Religion, Reassessing the History of an Idea. And Dr. John D. Wilsey received his PhD at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he is an assistant professor of history, and Christian apologetics at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He is the author of One Nation Under God, an Evangelical Critique in Christian America. And it's my honor and privilege to have you for the very first time on Iron Sharpens Iron, Dr. John D. Wilsey.
It's great to be here with you, Chris. Thanks a lot for having me.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. And I want to thank a pastor that I met in Harvey Cedars, New Jersey, the pastor that basically referred me to you, I believe is your pastor, correct?
He sure is. He's a great guy.
That's Pastor Benjamin, right?
Actually, Brian Jensen. Brian,
I'm sorry, Pastor Brian Jensen.
No, that's all right.
I kind of made a morph between Brian and Jensen and turned it into Benjamin.
Yeah.
Pastor Brian Jensen, and let's give Pastor Brian a plug for the church. Tell us something about the church where you're a member.
Yeah, it's Grace Family Church in Pearland, Texas, and we started visiting there in December, and we just joined recently, and it's a small church. It's a small Reformed church, and Pastor Brian is the basically the sole elder right now, and he does a great job of expository preaching. At that church, we have communion every Sunday following the service, which I think is excellent. And really, the whole service climaxes with the sharing of the Lord's of the elements of the Lord's table. So, me and my family really enjoy that. We also share a meal at the end of every service, a potluck meal at the end of every service, where we can fellowship with one another. And it's a really great model for community and expositional preaching, and a high view of God and God's Word.
Amen. Well, I got to say, I think as a conservative Christian, which I'm assuming you are, judging from the background of your education and your church membership, as a conservative Christian, this is kind of a gutsy book, I think, that you've written, because there are going to be a lot of people from the conservative realm of the Christian spectrum of ideology and theology who may get their the hairs on the back of their neck stand up, and they may get bristled and bothered and may even get furious by the premise of your book. But if you could tell us about, first of all, I think a definition is in order for American exceptionalism. Please tell us what that means.
Yeah, it's a famously ambiguous term. It's one of those terms that's commonly used by politicians, by thought leaders, by just everyday people. And the problem is that everybody, when people use it, the assumption is that everybody has the same definition, has the same understanding of what the term means. Kind of like other terms like freedom. Freedom is another one of those ambiguous terms. Everybody just assumes that everybody understands what it means, and there are actually a lot of definitions of it and a lot of understandings of it. But what I want to say about the definition basically is the idea that America, the greatest nation in the history of the human race, the most powerful nation in human history, the most important nation in terms of its prospect for doing good in the world, the more than just the greatest nation in the world, but really the greatest force for good that the world has ever seen. That America is the exception to the rule, that historical realities and historical sort of movements don't really apply to America in the same way that they've applied to other nations. In other words, other nations rise and fall, but that's not really the case with America. America doesn't rise and fall. All it does is rise. You may recall the speech that George H.W. Bush gave on the floor of the Republican National Convention when he accepted the Republican nomination in 1988 when he ran against Michael Dukakis. There's this moment where Bush says that he rejects the idea that America is a nation in decline, and he said America is a rising nation, and he got a huge response of applause from that line. And he made that statement in a sort of a historical moment where a lot of people were suggesting that maybe America was in decline and Japan was on the rise. In fact, there was a book that came out that very year called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, and that book by Paul Kennedy, the thesis of that book was that very idea, that America was in decline and that Japan was about to become the next great power, the next superpower on the world stage in the 21st century. It's a really interesting book now to think about because that obviously didn't happen. But nevertheless, this is what is usually thought of with American exceptionalism. This is the greatest nation in the world, the greatest force for good, and we need to continue the trend. We need to take policies. We need to pursue policies that encourage American exceptionalism, that acknowledge it, that encourage it, that seek to extend American hegemony in the world, because America is indispensable to global peace. And without America, and without America's position as the first superpower, then the world would descend into chaos. So that's commonly what's understood with American exceptionalism, but also what kind of goes along with that definition is that is a religious, a strongly theological element. And I identify five of those theological elements that often entail the idea of American exceptionalism in my book, and that is namely that God chose America, America is a chosen nation, a new Israel, that God has given America a divine commission to democratize the world. Some people say to make the world safe for democracy. That's a line that goes back to World War I and Woodrow Wilson. That America is enjoys a sacred land. It occupies a sacred land over here in the Western Hemisphere that God reserved, kind of hid from civilized man until just after the Reformation began. And also that America has a glorious past that we need to recover, that we have lost. And also that America is innocent of wrongdoing, that it's, America is a morally regenerate nation, and everything that America does is right. So those are five sort of religious or theological themes that sort of are entailed often in American exceptionalism. And as a Christian, as a conservative Christian, as a biblical Christian, I think it's important for us to reject religious or theological American exceptionalism because it hijacks from Christian theology. Mm-hmm. And makes the nation itself an object of worship.
Yeah, well, that's why I know some, not all, but probably a minority of pastors that I know do this, but they will not have an American flag near the pulpit in their church buildings, not because they're not patriotic, and not because they disdain this country that God has blessed us with and the freedoms accompanied with that, and not because of any disrespect towards the brave heroes of this country that fought and died for our freedoms here, but because of what you just said. They believe that Christ is the king of those from out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation all over the world, and therefore the church is not to be viewed as an American idea.
That's right. I mean, imagine, if you will, first century, second century, third century Christians gathered underground, gathered in a cave somewhere, gathered somewhere in secret, and the pastor expositing maybe Paul's letter to the Galatians or something like that, and behind the pastor as he's preaching to his little congregation there gathered in secret, the Roman standard over there back behind him in the corner. That's sort of an absurd idea. I don't think anybody would ever really imagine that. And so why would it be appropriate for the U.S. flag to be situated on the dais? Well, the only logical answer to that would be that, well, because this is a chosen nation. We want to link the nation with Christ and his universal kingdom. And so it's just not a logical, it's not a Christian notion to espouse.
Now, when you were going through the five primary things that you were going through, about American exceptionalism that should be rejected. One of them had to do with this being some kind of sacred land in the minds of many. Would you be specifically referring to Mormonism, or is there a broader group of people that have viewed it that way?
Yeah, I mean, the Mormons certainly seen the land in that way. What I do in the chapter that I write about the land is, for one thing, I look, it's more of how not just Mormons specifically, but Protestants have looked at the land. The land, you know, it's one thing. It's hard for us to really appreciate a really key aspect about American exceptionalism and about the physical land that we occupy. I mean, one thing that makes America exceptional, and I argue this in the book, that one thing that makes America exceptional is that the land is new. At least from a European perspective, this really was a new world. And when we say new, we mean new. I mean, new in every meaning of the word. I mean, we might go out and buy a new car, or, you know, we just bought a new air conditioning unit. We live in Houston, Texas. We need a new air conditioning unit in our house. I mean, we use the word new in sort of a common way, in a common use, but when we think about the new world and the discovery of America, the discovery of this continent, the colonization of this continent, the very opening decades of the 17th century, to those Europeans, we have to remember that this was like the discovery of a new planet for us. I mean, imagine astronauts taking off in a spaceship and finding if you're a Star Trek fan, which I am, an M-class planet, you know, a planet out there that's, you know, pretty much open to settlement, open to colonization, and is pristine. And we would regard it as, you know, something that would be life-changing, a paradigm shift, a worldview paradigm shift for everyone in the whole world. And, of course, that's what it is. And it's difficult for Europeans to really process the reality, this new reality that is in front of them when America is discovered and begins to be colonized. And so people, European colonists, had a choice when they encountered this new land, this new world, as they called it. They could either shift their own worldview and their own thinking and sort of adapt themselves to the new world that they had discovered, and also to the civilizations that were already here, the indigenous people that occupied the land for thousands of years. They could adapt themselves to these new realities, or they could act upon the land according to their existing worldview. You see what I'm saying? And what they chose to do was the second thing. They acted upon the land according to their own worldview and own presuppositions. And what that meant was they saw the land as given to them by God to be used however they saw fit. And the history of the Western Hemisphere, and particularly the land that the United States occupies, is the history mainly of how European settlers used the land in the way that they saw fit, according to their own presuppositions that they brought with them from Europe, that they did not sort of shift their own paradigm, their own worldview, to what had already existed. They were unable to do that. And we don't want to judge those people. We don't want to say that we would have done it differently, because probably we all would have done it the same way. It's human nature for us to sort of, you know, filter reality through our own existing worldview. And sometimes that meant good things, and sometimes that meant bad things. But one of the things that they had existing in their worldview was the dominion mandate of Genesis 1. Fill the earth and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. So their understanding of that was that they needed to make the earth bear fruit. They needed to make it productive. They needed to cultivate the earth and make it bear fruit. Well, you know, white Englishmen thought they knew how to do that. And then later on, when America became its own nation, white Americans thought they knew how to do that best. And they looked at Native Americans and saw that they weren't cultivating the land. There was no plantation economy, and there was no sort of European-style methods and ways of settling the land. So they thought that they weren't really fulfilling the dominion mandate, and thus it was okay to take the land. It was justifiable to take the land. John Quincy Adams made that claim in 1846 concerning the Oregon territories. And he had in mind the English, who were simply trapping and trading in furs and the indigenous tribes that were living there that were not cultivating the earth on a on the English model, which was to cultivate it and have plantations and have small family farms and that kind of thing. So because indigenous people weren't fulfilling the dominion mandate in the way that white Americans of the United States thought they should, that then it was justifiable for them to take the land. But that would have pretty big repercussions. Plantation economy especially would exhaust the soil of its nutrients, causing people to completely uproot themselves and move west, taking with them their slaves. That the expansion of slavery into the territories of the old Southwest, what we now know of as the lower Southeast, deep South areas. And ultimately, this would culminate in the fighting of the Civil War over many things, but primarily over slavery. I'm rehearsing a lot of the things I write in that chapter, but our view of the land, that this is a land given to us by God, and this is the homeland, this is the land for the chosen people, this is a sort of a narrative that goes back all the way to the Puritans who first settled in the 1620s.
Would be like John Winthrop and his view of this land as a city upon a hill and so on?
That's exactly right. It's a great example. John Winthrop writes this sermon called A Model for Christian Charity or Model of Christian Charity in 1630. And he situates, he sort of defines the colonists that are coming over to Massachusetts as God's chosen people. And the colony would be a city upon a hill, of course, drawing from Jesus' words in Matthew chapter 5.
Now, do you believe that there is an aspect of American exceptionalism that is very true in regard to the fact of, at least at one time, we were the freest land on the globe in regard to freedom of religion, and Christianity in its biblical a form was flourishing, and we were sending out missionaries unlike most nations and so on. And so there were things uniquely blessed about the United States of America or about the American colonies. And there were things about us that did separate ourselves from the lands in Europe that had kings and leaders that really had titles and roles that only belonged to Christ himself. And so there were aspects of us that basically made us unique on this planet as a people, but not, but it should never be viewed in a prideful way, whereas it has anything to do with us as an innately as a people. Something running through our bloodstream or in the soil that we are living on. And it has to do with the privileges and blessings and the stewardship that we have been entrusted with.
Yes. So we've been spending most of our time on this, in our time together today, talking about a religious or a theological expression in American exceptionalism that is really inappropriate, especially as a Christian. But in the book, it's not simply a critique of the idea. I want to make the case, and I try to make the case, that America is exceptional if we think about exceptionalism in a political or a social or historical way or historical method. For example, America is the only country, first and only country to be founded after the Enlightenment, but before the Industrial Revolution. America is the first constitutional republic. And in fact, every constitutional democracy, every constitutional government in the world is modeled somehow after the American Constitution, which is also the shortest constitution in the world. So these are just a couple of examples. The Declaration of Independence is the sort of the contractual basis of our nation, of our founding. The Declaration of Independence informs who we will be as a people and what our values will be as a people. In fact, Abraham Lincoln
when he is rising to prominence, national prominence in the late 1850s, and of course when he wins the presidency in 1860, much of his political ideology is informed by the Declaration of Independence, specifically the Equality Clause in the Declaration of Independence. Martin Luther King points to the moral examples of justice and equality that America professed in the Declaration of Independence and also other founding documents, like the Bill of Rights, for example, like Washington's Farewell Address. And even if you move ahead to the Gettysburg Address, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the second inaugural address made by Lincoln in 1865. So America is presents itself to the world as a beacon of hope to the oppressed, and the concept of liberty that America expresses is certainly the freest conception of liberty ever expressed by any nation in history. And so, indeed, these are areas where America can claim to be exceptional, historically and politically and socially. And so what I try to do in the book is differentiate between two expressions of exceptionalism. One is religious, it's theological. I call it closed exceptionalism. Closed, indicating that this form of exceptionalism is very exclusivist, and it shuts out some groups of people to the benefit of other groups of people who claim to be the chosen nation of God. And this is in distinction from open exceptionalism, which is, I think, a more appropriate form of exceptionalism to say that Americans enjoy. And, of course, this is a political and historical and social articulation. So, yes, I think that Americans can claim exceptionalism in sort of a, in a more humble way. We can think of ourselves as special, as different from other countries. But just because those things may be true and may be real doesn't give us the right to think of ourselves as commissioned by God or innocent or chosen by God in any way, shape, or form.
And what do you think is the most dangerous aspect of American exceptionalism when viewed wrongly? What are the most dangerous ramifications? Some who would say, what does this really matter? Why are you so upset about this? Why did you even take the time and effort to write a book about this? Why? What are you warning us about?
Okay, well, that's a great question. I've had a lot of interviews, and no one has ever really asked that question. That's a really good question. So, okay, if you're a Christian, the most dangerous thing about closed American exceptionalism is that it has the potential to shut you out of the kingdom of heaven. Because what it is really a heretical view of the nation state. It sets America up as a thing to be worshipped. If America is the chosen people of God, if America has a divine commission, if America is innocent of all wrongdoing and morally regenerate, if America is indeed a new Canaan, these are affirmations that are unbiblical, and they detract from the gospel of Jesus Christ, who, of course, came to give his life as a ransom for many. And it takes away from the glory of God, who says in Isaiah 48 that he will not share his glory with another. Those who would link America with the gospel also do danger to the legitimate Great Commission that Christ gave before he ascended into heaven. Thinking of American democracy and American power as being the means to an end, to spread the sort of gospel of democracy around the globe, and that this is what we're put on earth for, and that sort of misses the point of the gospel. And so I think for Christians, American exceptionalism is extremely dangerous because it obscures the gospel in ways that can really threaten the eternal destiny of the individual soul, if not careful.
In fact, I'm going to read a question because you unknowingly stole a listener's thunder a little bit who wrote in a question, but I'd like to give him at least credit for the question now. His name is Tyler in Mastic Beach, Long Island, New York. He actually wrote in for the first guest as well.
Yeah.
But Tyler says, what would you say about the problem with modern evangelicals worshiping the state and placing political philosophy and ideology over the worship of the triune God of Scripture. Now, obviously, I don't think anybody would consciously do that, but there are people that functionally do that. And perhaps if you could continue with what you've been saying, because obviously you've already answered that question to a degree, but perhaps if you could just continue.
Yeah, I could say a little bit more about that. There was a book that came out, I think it's 2004, 2006, by a gentleman by the name of David Glertner. And he wrote, the title of the book was called Americanism, the Fourth Great Western Religion. Now, if you just listen to the title of that book, you think, oh my goodness, that can't really be what the author is going to pursue in this book. And sure enough, I mean, that's definitely what he casts Americanism, is what he calls it, American ideals, American mission in the world, American identity, unapologetically in theological terms, calling Americanism a religion, a faith, right up there with Christianity. That's just absurd. I mean, that's just something that a biblical Christian has got to reject.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's just take this from the standpoint of a person, not necessarily a Christian person, not necessarily a religious person, just an American citizen. If we think that America has this sort of privileged position, well, first of all, that's a historically problematic position to take. We often hear that America is the most powerful nation in the history of mankind. And this statement is used as sort of this expresses our responsibility as a nation to go over the world looking for monsters to slay and monsters to destroy. Because we have an obligation to use our power to defeat threats to justice everywhere, because we're the most powerful nation in the history of the world. Well, you know, when you think about that that statement that we're the most powerful country in the history of the world, what does that even mean? I mean, are we going to sort of line, you know, 2016 America alongside of, I don't know, the British Empire of the 19th century and compare the two? Are we going to go toe-to-toe with Queen Victoria's England of, say, 1860? Well, we can't get in a time machine and go back and compare ourselves or fight a battle or compete on the world market. That's not really possible to do that. Are we going to go up against, you know, the Ming Dynasty of China? Are we going to go up against the Roman Empire? I mean, it's really an ahistorical, anachronistic way to think about American power. You don't compare American power to long-dead empires and say that we're more powerful than they are. There's no way that you can really substantiate that claim. Certainly, it's true that America is the most powerful nation in the world today, But to say that we're the most powerful nation in human history is really, I mean, if you don't mind me saying so, it's really an ignorant kind of a statement to make. But it's an exceptionalist statement. It's a statement made all the time, particularly by politicians, by those who would want to justify a foreign policy that is very interventionist and very expansionist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's dangerous. I think that kind of talk is dangerous. I mean, just look at the last 15 years or so. You know, we've made some foreign policy decisions that have not turned out the way that we were expecting and not the way we were promised that they would.
Mm-hmm.
For example, our intervention in Iraq in 2003 would be a very good example of that. But also the Vietnam War, which we pursued in the 1960s and 1970s. You know, this war was launched with good intentions, of course, and with the intention to, you know, fight communism in Southeast Asia. And, of course, we don't have time to rehearse the history of all that, but we all know how that story ended and how
right.
The story was narrated. And so Lyndon Johnson was responding to a speech on the Senate floor by J. William Fulbright, a senator from Arkansas. His speech was called The Arrogance of Power. Point was that, look, there are limits to American power. We can't do everything we would like to do. We can't, you know, we can't meet all of our objectives just because we want to do something somewhere in the world. Doesn't mean we have the means to do it, and doesn't mean we have the moral justification to do it. And Lyndon Johnson responded to that speech with another speech called The Obligation of Power, just a few months after Senator Fulbright gave his speech. basically he made the argument that, you know, we have the obligation to use our power over in Southeast Asia and in Vietnam. And we saw in Vietnam that there are limits to American power. And so the whole notion that there are limits to what we can do, not just physical limits or material limits, but there are also moral limits, is a fact that sometimes we as Americans are blinded to because of our great power.
Right. And the fact that, or should I say, the theory or the possibility that those behind the scenes in positions of power in America may have had impure or corrupt motives in our entrance into the war in Vietnam and other places does not take away from the very noble and pure motives of many American citizens who fought there. I think that there does need to be made a distinction needs to be made from brave heroes in the military who risked and lost their lives and even if they came home or often coming home maimed and with serious disabilities, they are still to be viewed as heroes, even if there was something going on beyond our knowledge in the private boardrooms and of the political elite and so on that we are unaware of. But
sure, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that distinction that you're drawing is a very important distinction to draw.
Oh, right. And right now we have to go to a station break, and we'll be right back. We do have a couple of listeners waiting to have their questions answered patiently.
Excellent.
And by the way, I want to let Tyler know, if you could please email me your full mailing address, because you have won, absolutely free of charge, a copy of Dr. John D. Woolsey's book, American Exceptionalism and Civil Religion, Reassessing the History of an Idea, Compliments of IVP Academic. That's a academic wing of InterVarsity Press. And we want to thank them for supplying us with these books to give away. So shoot us your full mailing address, Tyler, and we'll get that out to you as soon as possible. By the courtesy of CVBBS.com, Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, CVBBS.com, one of our sponsors who ships out all of these books free of charge at no postal expense to Iron Sharpens Iron, and we thank them very much for doing that. But we're going to be right back after these words from our sponsors, so do not go away.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man? Or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750. That's 508-528-5750. Or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org, that's ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org, or even on SermonAudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Attention coin collectors and investors. Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, so order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnson of Iron Sharpens Iron. If you just tuned us in, our second guest for today until 6 p.m. Eastern is Dr. John D. Wilsey, author of American Exceptionalism and Civil Religion, Reassessing the History of an Idea. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. Before I go on to any further listener questions, I have one of my own. I don't know if it's off topic to you, but I think it really dovetails on the same issue that we're addressing. There are people who are staunchly conservative in their Christian theology and even in much of their political ideology, but they very often unconsciously allow liberalism through the back door into religion when they stand up for certain American ideals and twist how they are to be utilized in the public arena where we are a multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multi-religious nation. And one of the things that I'm referring to is those conservatives who long for the day when a prayer was said over the PA system in the public schools, and how Bible was taught in the classroom and so on, and prayer was being promoted by teachers in prayer and so on. Now, I fully agree that students, as American citizens and as Christians, should have full freedom to exercise their right to religion and free speech, and they should be able to pray silently in classrooms, and they should be able to have Bible clubs and all kinds of Christian clubs to identify with other Christians and evangelize the Christian faith in the public schools. But to me, it makes no sense for a conservative Christian to want a principal or teacher in a public school who may be embracing a religion that is the antithesis of the Christian faith, and leading them in prayer and teaching anything about the Bible. Am I right there?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, this, I think you're referring back to a Supreme Court case that was handed down in 1962, Engle versus Vitale, which outlawed official school prayers. You know, of course, the country was made very different in the late 50s, early 60s. Back in those days, you know, there was a Protestant Catholic Jew, sort of a pluralistic society. But since about 1965, that is no longer the case. Our religious pluralism runs the gamut of just about every religious commitment known to man in the United States. And so school prayer, as it existed in the 50s and 60s, isn't what it would be today. School prayer would not, I wouldn't want, I really wouldn't want school prayer to be legalized in the United States, because there's no, just like you said, there's no guarantee that it would be a Christian prayer, and there's no guarantee that it would even be a even in the ballpark.
Right.
So, and
I'm assuming that you would agree with me, though, that a Christian student or teacher should be fully permitted to pray silently, or in appropriate places, pray vocally, audibly, and should have free exercise to start Bible clubs and Christian clubs and things like that.
Yes, absolutely. And, something like I used to be a youth minister for several years a while back, and every September 30th we would celebrate the time when students would gather at the flagpole and pray, and that's See at the Pole, I think is what that event was called every year. And that was always in my community where I used to live in Charlottesville, Virginia. That was something that happened at all the public schools, and it was something that was purely voluntary. It happened after school hour, or maybe it was before school hours it happened, and something that everybody was excited about. And if you weren't excited about it and you didn't want to join it, well, then you didn't have to. There's no worries there. And it wasn't something that was sanctioned by the school or handed down by the school system. It was a purely voluntary thing, which I think is really at the very heart of what religious freedom ought to be, something that's voluntary and not coerced or not handed down by a bureaucracy.
I mean, by the way, as a Christian, even though I want to maintain a purity of worship and prayer that does not involve people with false religions joining with us in praying and so on, I do not believe that there should be the power in the government to stop a local public school from having any kind of public prayer or anything. I didn't mean to indicate that I wanted a heavier hand of government to restrict religious activity in the public schools or public square. I'm just talking about those conservative evangelicals and fundamentalists who are on one hand demanding or insisting that we should have these teachers and principals reading prayers over the PA system when they could be a Jehovah's Witness or who knows what else, a Muslim whatever.
You could be a Satanist.
Gaining
steam, especially like in places like Oklahoma. And I think we would all agree, conservative or liberal alike, if you're a confessing Christian, that we wouldn't want our children subjected to something like that.
We do have Christopher in Suffolk County, Long Island, who is asking, what level of patriotism do you believe Christians should publicly display in regard to the love of country and flag? Don't you believe that if we have been blessed by God living in a country that has afforded us much opportunity and freedom, that we should be publicly, frequently evoking much gratefulness and thankfulness to our nation and those who have lived before us and paid the price for maintaining freedom here?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and a question that I seek to address in my book. I try to draw a distinction between patriotism and nationalism. In patriotism, we celebrate the blessings of God upon our land and upon our people in times past and in contemporary times. Patriotism is something that brings us together. And that's what, the title of my book refers to civil religion. Civil religion is one of those terms that academics use a lot, but it's really a pretty simple term. Civil religion is a political construct or a social construct that casts the nation in relationship to God and relationship to other nations. And so, like when you go to to a military cemetery, if you go to Arlington Cemetery in Washington, D.C., you'll notice that it has a lot of religious sort of themes that you're walking around and noticing. The changing of the guard of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is a religious event because it demonstrates the transcendence of the sacrifice that has been made on our behalf by brave men and women who have laid down their lives for our freedom. And it's something that it has a liturgy to it, and it has a sort of a priesthood. Those soldiers that guard the tomb are something of priests that are guarding the men that lay there as unknown soldiers. The liturgy is every half hour there's a changing of the guard. It's a religious liturgy that is observed when you go there, and it's not a salvation kind of a thing. It's not. It doesn't cast America in any salvific terms. It doesn't cast America in any ecclesiological terms. That is, as a nation, as a church, or anything like that. It doesn't do any kind of violence to the gospel, or it doesn't replace the authority of Scripture over our lives with anything else. But it is religious, and patriotism in that sense, I think is very appropriate, to an expression of gratitude to God for His blessings on our land. But patriotism also entails calling out the nation for sins against justice. When we, for example, are as conservative Christians are concerned about government intrusion upon religious freedom, our expression of our religious convictions in the public square, our protest against those kinds of infringements on our liberty, those are expressions of patriotism. And whenever we dissent against the government over ideals that are written in our founding documents, that's an expression of patriotism. When African Americans that were led by the African American churches in the 50s and 60s rose up and said enough is enough in regards to segregation and in regards to the denial of civil rights and basic services and access to the good things that Americans have historically had access to, that was patriotism. And in fact, if you read Martin Luther King's speeches, Martin Luther King is certainly a patriot, even though he's coming against official government policy. So dissent against the government can be, it's not always necessarily, but it has a very strong patriotic element to it. And there's always, just like the scriptures say in Ecclesiastes, there's a time and a place for everything. I don't think that Sunday morning in church, when we are gathered together to hear the word of God preached and to worship the name of the Lord Jesus who died on the cross to make atonement for sin, I don't think that that's the time to express gratitude to God for our freedom. I think that's the time to worship Christ, because that's the time that we set aside on the Lord's Day to worship the name of Christ. I don't think it's appropriate to make the celebration of America the primary thing, especially around Memorial Day and the 4th of July and Veterans Day and so forth. But I think that the church certainly can set aside time to express gratitude to God for our country, a Sunday night service, a Wednesday night service, or a special time that we might gather as a local congregation on a picnic on a Monday afternoon or something like that. I think those are perfectly appropriate, but there's a time and a place and a season for all things. And I think that Christians need to be thoughtful and not just because something seems worth doing at a particular given time, that it's always appropriate to do that.
We have Arnie in Perry County, Pennsylvania, who wants to know, I know that the Jehovah's Witnesses are a cult, but they view saluting the flag as an act of idolatry. Do you agree with their view on that, even though you're not in that cult? And do you know of any Christians historically who shared that understanding of saluting the flag and treating it with reverence?
Yeah, so that's a complicated one. It's a tough one. Because, if we go to a baseball game, every baseball game that we go to, whether it's a minor league game or a major league game or, mm-hmm. Your child's little league game, just about every baseball game I've ever been to, how does every game begin? It begins with the Star-Spangled Banner.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do whenever you hear the Star-Spangled Banner sung? Well, you stand up and you put your hand over your heart. And I teach my children to do that whenever the Star-Spangled Banner is sung. and that there's a particular etiquette that you have. Whenever the flag is present, you face the flag. If the flag is not present, you face the music. And you put your hand over your heart in salute. And it's very appropriate, I think, to do that. I think it's always about the time and the place and the context. I don't think it's appropriate to do that in a church service, because I think that it takes the place. It overshadows the glory of Christ, and it overshadows the reason why we gather together as believers. Pledging the flag is a little bit complicated, because what are you doing in that? You're pledging unconditional loyalty to the nation. You know, and I think that's appropriate in certain contexts, but in other contexts it might not be appropriate to pledge undying, unconditional loyalty to a nation. What happens when the nation begins to, for example, deny Christians religious freedom, or deny anybody religious freedom? Do we really want to pledge unquestioned, unconditional loyalty to a nation state that denies the religious freedom of Christians or other groups to gather and according to the dictates of their conscience? I don't know. I don't think so. So it's something that Christians need to think about. Think very deeply about. I don't know that there is an absolute answer, right or wrong answer, to give. But I think it is something that needs to be thought about contextually, and you know, also there's a great deal of heart self-examination that needs to go on. Are we in our own heart of hearts? Are we exalting the nation above our God? That's something that every individual needs to examine in their own heart and their own life.
Do you know of any Christian group that was opposed to reverence towards the flag? I know that the Jonathan Edwards is considered like the last Puritan, so there wasn't a lot of history with an American flag with the Puritans' involvement, but they had a British flag in England and so on.
Flags were first put or displayed publicly in churches around the time of the Civil War, and particularly during World War I, flags were displayed prominently. I'm not 100% sure. I wouldn't want to say with any certainty, well, this group or that group.
Uh-huh.
I believe the Mennonites, and I'm not a Mennonite, I'm a Baptist, but I believe the Mennonites have historically rejected doing that or have backed off from doing that. And increasingly today, more and more Baptist churches are backing off from the display of American flags in their church services. I have to say, I have to confess a little bit of ignorance. I'm not sure, but it's a great question.
And I want to make sure that you share with our audience what you most want etched on their hearts and minds before the conclusion of this program.
Yeah, I would just point to Revelation 22:17, which is the closing invitation that Scripture gives towards all humanity to come to Christ and to put their faith in Him. The verse reads, "The Spirit and the Bride say, 'Come,' and let the one who hears say, 'Come,' and let the one who is thirsty come, and let the one who desires take the water of life without price." You know, that's an invitation to salvation on the basis of Christ's atoning work on the cross. And when you think about the gospel in those terms, in biblical terms like that, there is a stark contrast when we think about American greatness and American exceptionalism and are we the chosen people. I think that Christians need to think deeply about this. I think this is an idea that matters. I think it's good to affirm American exceptionalism in certain ways. And in other ways, it's highly problematic, in fact, maybe even heretical or blasphemous to do so. And, you know, when it comes to the accurate presentation of the gospel in this very troubled world that we live in, an idea like American exceptionalism and its place in our minds and in our hearts is a very important concept.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, and I look forward to having you back again.
Yeah.
Brother, you did a really wonderful job today, and it was very enlightening.
Thank you.
And we could definitely go on for another hour or more.
Sure.
Talking about things like this. Now, I want to give a plug to Pastor Brian Jensen's church again, Grace Family Church. The website is gracefamilyinfo.org, gracefamilyinfo.org. And what city and state is that again?
I'm sorry?
What city and state is Grace Family Church?
It's Pearland, Texas.
Pearland, Texas.
Yes.
And any other contact information that you care to share today?
Yes. I have a blog, a website. It's johndwilsey.com. It's a very, I try to make it easy to remember.
And Wilsey is W-I-L-S-E-Y.
S-E-Y, yes. It's like when your children ask for ice cream, you say, Wilsey.
Well, thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners that I hope you have a joyful, safe, and blessed Memorial Day weekend. And reach out to the families and loved ones of veterans and veterans themselves and thank them for their service. We'll see you next week on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far, far greater Savior than you are a sinner. God bless.